This past week, I was at CYF camp, which is our church camp for high school youth. In our region, there was a change this year with the organization of the camps. For as long as I can remember, with this age group, with the CYF camp, there were three camps. They were identified as 15, 16, and 17. 3 decades ago, in this region, I attended Camp 16. As you can imagine, over those years, each camp gained its own personality and reputation. Counselors and campers returned to the same camp year after year. Traditions were developed. This year, they changed things up. With the newer camp facilities and the number of campers attending, it no longer made sense to offer 3 camps. So instead, there were 2 that should be able to house the same number of campers. Meanwhile, everyone was aware that change is hard. Traditions and dates and communities develop, and disruptions can be difficult. We also went into camp aware that we were combining campers who had previously had separate identities, and if we're honest, who were from camps that sometimes had been a bit competitive with each other. So the questions were alive in our conversations. Would the kids from different camps merge well? What traditions should be maintained? And what ones needed to just be let go? What would the new traditions be? Would we end up with a camp filled with groups of campers, those from a history with one camp over here and those from a history with another camp over there? These questions were real because change is hard and because people tend to group with people who are like them or people with whom they have something in common. Now, I'm happy to say, and I think Alex Wheeler would agree with me, that the camp went well this week. Is that a fair statement? Yeah. Different groups merged together, and they found a new identity as one camp. They didn't stand at their borders and hold fast to their traditions in ways that didn't allow new people in. Rather, they were willing to welcome new friends, to embrace new traditions, and even to let go of some beloved practices. And throughout the experience this week, I had this passage that Maggie read us from Ezra swirling around in my head. Another story about the identity of a group and the choice to include or not. So let's begin this look at Ezra by remembering what is going on. And the story really begins hundreds of years earlier. We remember that after Abraham was called to go to a new land and become the father of a new people, after Moses was raised up and led the people out of bondage, after the people wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, a time that allowed them to figure out who they understood God was asking them to be, after they settled in the land they understood to be promised to them and lived for a while in a system of judges, after all of this, the people asked for a king. They wanted to be like other nations and have a centralized government, not just under God, but with a king, a person they could see and hear and name. In spite of the downsides, and we looked at this story several weeks ago, we remember that God let them have a king, and Samuel anointed Saul. There was then a series of 3 kings, perhaps the best known biblical kings, Saul, followed by David, followed by Solomon. But that was the end to one centralized government. Following Solomon, Israel divided into 2 kingdoms, the northern kingdom, which took the name of Israel, the southern kingdom, then called Judah. And for many years, they lived side by side with different kings, sometimes becoming allies against a common enemy, sometimes fighting between them themselves. Then, Around the year 721, this is BCE, this is a long time ago, the northern kingdom fell to the great power Assyria. Now the southern kingdom, they breathed a sigh of relief. Glad it wasn't them, and probably feeling a bit of arrogance because they had Jerusalem in their kingdom and felt like it was invincible. But then, around 587, the same happened to them. Not to Assyria, but this time they fell to the Babylonians. Defeat led to the exile of their leaders, the landed people, those with money and with power. They were sent to exile, and they lived in exile for a period of years, ranging from decades to more than a century. Their hope came when the Persians defeated the Babylonians, and Cyrus, the Persian leader, encouraged the return of the Israelites to the land and even gave them resources to start rebuilding. And yet, it's never quite that simple. Many years and many leaders later, we get to the point where we are in the story today, where Ezra and Nehemiah, those two books of the Bible, show up and continue to tell us what's going on. And at this point, there are still many in exile. Still, the city of Jerusalem has not returned to its former glory. Still, the temple had not been rebuilt. And because so much time has passed, this means that there are many Israelites who have never known Jerusalem. Many who have never lived in the Promised Land. Many who have never known what it is to live under Jewish rule. Meanwhile, they've also been living in what is technically a foreign land, but what has become home, with people and religions and customs, many of which are different from those of the Israelites, or at least those the Israelites had before the exile. What this means is that as they return, they are trying to discover again, or really for many of them, for the first time, what it means to be Jewish, what it means to have this particular relationship with God, what it means to reclaim their lost identity. And what we witness in these verses from Ezra is that some of their leaders' approach is to define that identity narrowly and hold on to it strongly for fear of losing it again. It is into this context that today's reading comes, and into this context that we hear these words: "We have broken faith with our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. So now let us make a covenant with our God to send away all these wives and their children, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God. And let it be done according to the law. Take action, for it is your duty, and we are with you. Be strong and do it." If you hear these words and gasp, good for you. If you listen to that passage and your heart hurts at the thought of sending away your spouse and your children because they come from a different place than you do, then I suspect you actually aren't very different from most of the people who heard these words in Ezra's day. But what do we do with this? What do we do when we have a reading that claims that as the answer? Well, certainly one approach is that we can simply opt to just dismiss it. Many among us are especially willing to do this with passages from the Hebrew Scriptures when we experience conflict over them. Having said that, I'm never sure that's the best approach. Another approach is for us to wonder together. Why? Why did this make sense? What were they afraid of? What was going on? Again, if we remember that they had lost their identity and their home, then maybe we can at least understand why they might have moved to that extreme. Why, when they felt threatened, it could have made sense to build some borders, to clarify who was in and who was out, to remove what they felt threatened by. Even if we don't agree with this approach, perhaps we can at least understand how they got there. And then we might also remember this. The words we hear from Ezra aren't the only words we hear on this topic. In fact, a book of the Hebrew Scriptures that's placed earlier in our Bible, set in an earlier time, is understood by some scholars to have been recorded during this same period, and that's the book of Ruth. If you remember the story of Ruth, it is the story of a foreign woman who chooses to return to Israel with her mother-in-law, even when everything that is reasonable says she would have had a better life if she had stayed in her own land and returned to her father's home. But instead, we read in the book of Ruth how Ruth chooses to go with Naomi, and not only does she return to Israel with her, but she marries a Jewish man, and that foreign woman becomes the great-grandmother of the beloved King David. A foreign woman's lineage produces a beloved Jewish king. So on this journey that we are taking this summer of looking again and reading again at some of these passages that are difficult or that we have questions about, we are reminded that rarely is the answer simple. Sure, we can pull a sentence out of the Bible, remove it from its context, and apply it to support anything we want and call it a day. But that's not faithful to the text. We must have the context and we must hear the rest of the story. Here is the reality. There were conflicted voices on the question of how this should be handled, how the people of Israel should relate to the people who were from a foreign land, but who now were a part of them, were their family. Yes, there were some who couldn't see past exclusion, who feared for all that had been lost and the reality that it could happen again, who didn't know any way to protect themselves other than to cut out anyone who wasn't just like them and to create a culture of like-minded and like-committed people. And yes, there were also some who couldn't see why exclusion was necessary, who not only remembered the stories of the many places in their history where foreigners had become allies, but also remembered the stories where foreigners had become part of the community. It is important that we pay attention to the scriptures and that we engage the conversation that the Bible is engaging within itself. So it is important that we remember things, such as the things that the kids I was at camp with this last week were remembering, that the Bible is not a single book with a single author and a single story, but it is a library of various genres of literature written over the span of thousands of years by many authors. The Bible is a library of books connected by the commitment to God and their connection to the Judeo-Christian tradition, but it is not one book with like-minded stories or a single narrative with no conflict. So what do we do? On one hand, the tradition of Ezra tells the people to purify, to allow only their own, to even send away those who are already connected because their background isn't Jewish. On the other hand, the tradition of Ruth reminds us of a foreign woman who is essential to the story, who becomes the great-grandmother of King David. And along with Ruth, we have other words, such as those from the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, refrains that remind the people of Israel of the importance of caring for the stranger and welcoming the foreigner because they were once strangers in a land not their own. Again, we are reminded that the Bible is a place to begin conversations. We are not faithful if we pull out our favorite verse to support our favorite argument and ignore the complexity. We struggle alongside the ancient people with questions of welcome and inclusion, with questions of what these values mean for our identity. And again, we are reminded, as people who follow Jesus, that finally, we lay our struggles next to the example he set. So when we wonder who is included and if some should be kept out, we look to the one who crossed boundaries, who touched the untouchable, who ate with those considered unclean. When we wonder who is outside of the love of God, we look to the example of Jesus, who met everyone with God's love. When we wonder whether we should be a people divided by principles and practices, by lands and beliefs, we look to the one who was the great unifier, who brought together a great variety of people in God's loving embrace. Amen.